Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dat-gum, dat-gum, dat-gum government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh.
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, the Rebel Madman, Mike Getty, tonight. Going to be an interesting show tonight. Mike, you want to say hello?
Hi, guys. Hope everyone is doing well in these crazy times in 2021.
Crazy it is. You know, when you suggested using that song as an intro, I had no idea how it would become more relevant as time goes by, because right now, dadgum government, man, how many times are we hearing that from almost everybody we want to talk to today? It is absolutely a crazy time, and I think tonight we're gonna try to give some people some backstory, if you will, to how we got here and what we're facing right today. But, you know, if somebody were to look at our topics tonight, talking about the delegates of 1787 and then talking about the war on pure races or the white race, as you had suggested, and then talking about a new call for a con, you would think that those three may not be connected, but in fact, they very much show the real spine of the evil we've been facing from day one. So I'm going to open us with a quick prayer, Mike, and then let you get into the delegates of 1787. Is that okay?
That's perfect. Go ahead, buddy.
Almighty Father, your son is our king. And we know that we need this personal relationship with the Messiah, your son, your only begotten son. And we don't want to be deceived in these very confusing times. We want to see truth around us, and we know that the only way we can do that is to allow your Ruach, your Spirit, to work in us and through us and around us and open our minds and our eyes and remove the scales from our eyes. So, Father, we invite that. We invite your Spirit. We want to see the truth, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how much evil is revealed. Father, do not allow us to be deceived. We want you to have control of our thoughts and our actions, and especially tonight, our words. So we give that control to you. Be with Mike, be with our listeners, and be with me tonight as we try to bring a little bit of truth forward and help people to handle that. So in the name of your son, our Savior, our King, Yahshua HaMashiach, that we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Well, Mike, give us this lesson on the delegates of 1787.
Well, Terry, one of the things, as I got into this several years ago and was fortunate enough to be at the National Archives and the Library of Congress and fortunate enough to be able to look into the documents at the University of Virginia and some at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, University of South Carolina, to look at some of these documents, especially from the beginning, what we would call the beginning of our country. And then one of the things in classes and listening to, I've never heard – anyone go into any detail about collectively who were the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, how were they selected, and ultimately, whom did they represent? And once you get into that and do a, as we call, a deep dive research into it, you quickly come to understand that the most famous three words to deal with our Constitution, we the people, you suddenly begin to realize that that is probably one of the greatest words of deception or phrases of deception in the history of man. Because we the people would indicate that this government, this Constitution that was written, composed in Philadelphia in 1787, was created for we the people. And in actuality, if it was going to be accurate, it should be we some of the people would be much more accurate. And so the state legislatures picked the delegates to the Constitution in Philadelphia. And there were originally 74 delegates from 12 states that were selected. Rhode Island chose not to participate. And it should be stipulated from the very beginning, when Rhode Island refused to participate, according to the Constitution of the day, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, when Rhode Island failed to participate, the convention became unconstitutional at that point because of Article 13 in the Articles of Confederation, which was, if we can use the phrase, the law of the land in May of 1787. That was the law of the land. Those were the rules that people were to go by. So there were delegates selected by the legislature. When Rhode Island refused to participate, then it became an illegal meeting. Unlawful, unconstitutional, however you want to say it. But anyway, that would have to be true. So of those 74 that were selected, we have, let me see the exact number, 19 refused to attend. And we know, number one, that Richard Henry Lee was selected in Virginia, and he was ill at the time, and he said he could not attend. Also, we know that Patrick Henry stated that he would not attend the Constitutional Convention because he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia. And that isn't mentioned very often, that Patrick Henry would not attend. I so wish that he would have attended. That would make a great deal of difference. I believe it would have been wonderful to have had him there with his passion and with his Christian faith to have, I believe he would have made a huge difference, but he wasn't there, and he chose not to attend. I have somewhere, and I was searching for it today, I couldn't find it, but I have all 19 did not attend for one reason or another. But of those who did attend, we probably had what would later become Anti-Federalists, we probably had two that were there, and that would have been Elbridge Gerry and George Mason. Those probably would have been what we, if you wanted to use that crazy phrase, moderates, would have probably been those two. And but they were totally sympathetic to coming to the convention as a device for strengthening the Articles. Now, we have to understand again that every delegate who went to the convention went there with the mandate from their state to amend the Articles of Confederation to meet certain exigencies that existed and to submit those amendments to the states for ratification. But it is obvious from letters between James Madison, John Jay, George Washington, Edmund Randolph, and others, several delegates went there with the total and entire purpose of creating a new constitution, regardless of what their states had told them to do. That is something I think we have to think of today, Terry, when we start talking about a constitutional convention, a con-con, for an Articles of Confederation, you know, the convention, an Article 5 convention, that those are absolutely things that we must consider what happened in 1787, because how would we know if we sent people there that they weren't all to amend the Constitution? How would we know that they hadn't already created a plan, just like they did in 1787, to create a new Constitution and throw the other one out the window? And it doesn't make any difference what they're authorized to do, because we found out in 1787 that just didn't work. But anyway, to get more into detail, the nationalist strength, or the nationalist, federalist, monarchist, many of them were monarchists, and they admitted to it. And John Mercer from Maryland, a delegate from Maryland, actually sent a paper home and said that at least 13 of the delegates who were there were confirmed monarchists. But then their strength tended to come not only from the wealthy and the wealthy aristocracy, but also from urban commercial interests. In other words, most of these delegates, well, almost all of them, were from the big cities. England used to talk about the country and the court, and the clash between the country and the court. That was the clash between urban and rural. We still have that in America. We still have that clash between urban and rural. So we had it there, but the problem is that rural America of 1787 was not represented at that convention in any way, shape, form, or fashion. So, in short, the nationalist strength came from men who supported centralizing the government to collect tariffs and to create navigation laws, raising the value of their own estates, and on aggressive and to establish an aggressive foreign policy, all at the expense of the taxpayer. Because this is what they wanted to do, was to create the taxes to pay for what they wanted to protect themselves as people in business. Not anything different from most of the people who go to the run for politics today. Surprisingly, in 7 of the 12 states, no representatives whatsoever at the convention came from the inland farmers or the rural, which was a clear and enormous weighting of the convention in favor of the nationalist monarchist. In other words, the urban had a majority from the very beginning. Typical, let's talk about Massachusetts. Of the 4 delegates who attended from Massachusetts, 3 were from the commercial seaboard, and 1 was a nationalist follower of Theodore Sedgwick from the commercial Connecticut Valley town of Northampton. None of the numerous small inland towns were represented, to say nothing of the Shaysites from western Massachusetts, the Daniel Shays, the people who had revolted against the taxes. They had no representation whatsoever at the Constitutional Convention, probably for obvious reasons. The 2 New Hampshire delegates came from the main commercial seaboard town of Portsmouth. So New Hampshire sends 2 delegates, both from the same town. Now, you're going to find this to be consistent. None of the 3 Connecticut delegates represented the inland farmers either, and all came from the commercial towns east of the Connecticut Valley. Now, in Pennsylvania, here we see something that the same thing we saw from New Hampshire. In Pennsylvania, all 8 delegates came from the town of Philadelphia. Not one member of the delegation to the Constitutional Convention came from the agrarian Western Pennsylvania. Not one. Zero. All eight from the same town. Ironically, South Carolina, all of the delegates from South Carolina came from Charleston. No one represented the upland farmer in that one. The five North Carolina delegates all came from the commercial planter-dominated northeastern section of the state. Now, Virginia's a little bit different. In Virginia's complex political, economic geography, there were seven or eight major sections, of which two, the lower river valleys and especially the old feudal North Neck oligarchy of the Potomac, were the nationalist large planter. Of the seven-man Virginia delegation, two men came from the North Neck and four from the lower river valleys. Only James Madison from Orange County did not fit the picture of the other delegates as being a prominent plantation or farm owner. And he came from an area not too far from the upper Rappahannock, but Madison was a strong Federalist nationalist. So what of the other states? Democratic Georgia, it is true, sent two delegates from the east and two from the west, but it was overwhelmingly Federalist, all four delegates. For its part, Maryland was always accessible to the sea and was ultimately all eastern planter-run tidewater representative. Delaware distributed its five delegates between New Castle County and the two southern agricultural counties, which was unusual, but the whole of the small state was largely a tributary of Philadelphia and the Delaware River, and consequently, Delaware, too, was overwhelmingly nationalist monarchist. New Jersey had no east-west division in the commercial agricultural, as did most of the other states. Instead, there were two areas in New Jersey at that time. It was East Jersey, which was basically a suburb of New York City, and the other, West Jersey, was affiliated with Philadelphia, both of whom were strong nationalist cities. It is no surprise, then, that the state was overwhelmingly nationalist throughout the 1780s. Now, the only state that sent a majority of what you would call anti-federalist or anti-monarchist or anti-nationalist was New York. New York sent three representatives to the Constitutional Convention. All three were lawyers: Alexander Hamilton, Robert Yates, John Lansing Jr. Now, on June the 18th, Alexander Hamilton presented before the Constitutional Convention a complete monarchy. A monarchical form of government is what he presented on June the 18th. And shortly after that, the two other delegates from New York, now that was Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. Now, I think it's critical to note that both of them, as delegates, were members of the New York Supreme Court. But in early July, both Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. left the convention, wrote a letter to Governor Clinton explaining that they could no longer participate in the Constitutional Convention, because the convention would, to have done so would be to exceed the authority that they were given by the people of the state of New York. And the letter is available for any of those who would like it. Just look up, you know, the Yates and Lansing letter to George Clinton. It's available on the internet. And they very, you know, those were two men of principles. They said to have stayed would have been to exceed the authority that had been given to us by the states. So there were two honest men, and they could not continue to participate. But that didn't keep us from ending up with a constitution from that convention. And, of course, the two men I mentioned earlier, along with Edmund Randolph, he refused to sign. But Elbridge Gerry and George Mason refused to sign the Constitution on September 17th, 1787, and George Mason said he would rather chop off his right hand. And, you know, that's being pretty graphic, saying you would rather chop off your hand than sign that document. Why is that not looked at? You know, why is this not studied? The other thing I think is that I found rather remarkable was 10 of the delegates, Terry, to the Constitutional Convention of 1787 were members of the sitting Congress under the Articles of Confederation. 10 members of the Congress were sent to the Constitutional Convention, and they helped prepare a document which was completely unconstitutional from the Constitution they were serving in Congress under. So then after they helped write a Constitution like that, they then returned from Philadelphia to New York and vote on whether to send the document they produced to the states for ratification. Which, you know, the whole thing begins to sound just like what we have today. You have a group of people with authority who keep playing the game over and over and over again. That was a conflict of interest. The other
had
thing
those
that was a
10,
conflict of interest. Go ahead.
Had those 10 not sworn an oath to the Articles of Confederation?
They absolutely had. Didn't
so they
seem
were in
to
violation
bother
of their
any. Yeah, well, I was, just to throw something in from, I keep up with those charts that show how members of Congress vote constitutionally. And I heard today, just throwing this in before we get back to the subject, was that Tim Kaine, who was a vice presidential running mate under Hillary Clinton from Virginia, he was raising some Dickens about, this impeachment thing was constitutional, all this other stuff. And he mentioned the Constitution three or four times in a presentation that I heard. And I went back and checked his voting record with the Constitution. And since he's been a senator from Virginia, he has voted consistent with the Constitution less than 4% of the time. That is interesting to do, to go out and find how these representatives have voted with the Constitution. That is a great deal of fun. But anyway, to get back to the subject. So we had a group, 10 members of Congress, who went to the Constitutional Convention and proposed a destruction of the Constitution they were serving under. That, again, I think is something that should be, send up red flags when we talk about a new Article 5 convention or a CONCON. So that, too. But the other thing that I think is most relevant is how many people who were stockholders in the Bank of North America who were due money and interest from the government were actually present in Philadelphia voting to raise taxes to make sure they were paid the money they had coming. Is that not also a conflict of interest?
Well, especially that we know that they purchased a lot of those bonds from people, states and holders of the war bonds. We know that they bought a lot of that at 10 or 20 cents on the dollar.
Well, we also know that many of the stockholders of the Bank of North America who were due interest on loans to the government also didn't pay anything for the stock they had because the money was loaned to them to purchase that stock by Robert Morris. And that's documented in the Library of Congress. When he established in 1782 the Bank of North America, he loaned money to at least 90 some people to buy stock in the Bank of North America The money that he loaned them to buy stock came from $400,000 in gold and silver that the government had received from France to help support them in the war against England. And so the first thing he does is he loans them money as the financier for the revolution. He loans these people, 90-some people, he loans them money to buy stock in the bank, then takes that money. He loaned the money that belonged to the government to start with. And the government, and then they buy stock in the bank, which he then loans the money to the government. So the government now owes the people who had nothing invested except on borrowed money. Now the government owes the interest. Think about this. The government owes the principal and the interest both to France for loaning them the money and to Robert Morris and the stockholders in the Bank of North America. So the people of the country have to be taxed to pay double interest on that loan. And so these
and
people end
to
up
be perpetual.
Yes. And so they end up.
Were there 55 delegates then? Was 55 the correct number of delegates?
55 actually were there, but by the time they got to the end, there was only 39 that signed the Constitution, Terry. And
okay,
of the 39.
Now, of the 39, how many of them were Federalists?
Well, all of them were Federalists, and 26 of them were lawyers.
And of the ones that left, how many of them were anti-federals?
Well, Luther Martin left. John Mercer left. They were both anti-federalists. John Lansing Jr. and Robert Yates, that I mentioned before, they ended up writing anti-federalist papers. Robert Yates wrote under the name Brutus. Luther Martin was the attorney general from the state of Maryland, the longest sitting attorney general in U.S. history, and he was an anti-federalist, and he wrote under the term general information. John Lansing Jr. wrote a couple of that were listed under simply a farmer as anti-federalist writing. So most of the people who left that we know of were anti-federalists. John Mercer was also an anti-federalist, and he wrote against adopting the Constitution.
Well, if they had not had to go through the ratification process, and had none of those anti-federalists have been there to fight against and eventually walk out on what they were doing, what kind of document would have been approved by those Federalists had they thought they could get away with it?
Well, one of the things that happened when Hamilton, on June the 18th of 1787, Hamilton introduced a strict monarchy form of government, would have been a governor-king, as he phrased it, who would rule for the duration of his life. They would have an elected kind of like a parliament under Madison's plan, but the governor king could overrule or veto anything they ever did. The governor king would also appoint the governors of each one of the states for lifetime positions. And then again, the governor king could veto anything the states ever proposed. So it was basically a monarchy, and Hamilton proposes that, and then it becomes a problem because then James Madison makes the statement, Hamilton let the cat out of the bag. And then if you look at the letters among the Federalists after the convention, they all mention, especially Thomas Sedgwick in letters to Benjamin Rush and others keep mentioning, well, you know, we couldn't get everything we wanted in the beginning, but we will add it in the first Congress, which ironically they did because the Federalists controlled the first Congress. 20 out of 22 senators in 17, when the government started, 20 out of 22 senators were Federalist, and 39 in the House were Federalist, and 11 were Anti-Federalist. So there were 13 total Anti-Federalists in the first U.S. government. And so it was a supermajority of Federalists. And one of the first things the Federalists did in the Congress was to come up with the Judicial Act of 1789, which was totally unconstitutional because it completely amended Article 3 of the Constitution. They did not believe Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Were any of the delegates elected, Bill?
Were any of the delegates elected? They were elected by their state legislatures.
Okay. So today, the process for selecting those delegates is not clearly defined, but we know that Article 5 says that the U.S. Congress will call the convention, and therefore the Congress, being the entity to call the convention, will control the selection of delegates for any new Article 5 convention.
Absolutely. So what happens if they pick 10 members of Congress? Just like they did in 1787. Yes. What if they picked some of the, we want to talk about Federalists, let's call them today, let's call them liberals or conservatives. What if the majority of people picked to attend this new constitutional convention were all liberal progressives, or at least a large majority of them? What
or
if they
controlled
did
opposition,
pick a,
which is what we find significantly. I mean, there's what, maybe a handful of the elected officials in Washington, D.C. that are possibly not controlled opposition.
Here is the thing, Terry. If they picked a new, and this is the question I've asked, and I've had people get really angry at me because I don't support a new constitutional convention, because that's the cure-all. That's the thing that'll fix everything if we can just do that. But here is my point, is that, is who would select the people who go there, and what is put in place that would make them adhere to the rules, because the first constitutional convention didn't adhere to the rules in place. The Articles of Confederation.
Well, we know how the rules are established at a convention like that. They're not established in advance. So any rules that are put forth in advance can be tossed out or not even considered. The rules are established once the officers of the convention are elected by the delegates, and it's at that point that the rules of the convention are approved, not before.
Just like 1787.
Fascinating.
And in 1787, Washington was elected president or chairman, which everybody thought would happen. And then they go about setting up the rules. Number one, and this is critical because there's something I wanted to point out with this too. This is critical because Washington established and the rules were established. Luther Martin complained about the rules, but to no avail. The rules were is that it was a secret meeting. It would be held in secret. There would be guards at the door to prevent anyone from coming in from outside. There would be curtains or blankets put up over the windows so no one could look in. It would be on the second floor so no one could look in or hear what was going on. And then they would do not reveal anything that happened at that convention for 50 years. Now, I'm sure there are people who would say today, well, that wouldn't happen again. Well, how could you guarantee that? How could you guarantee
The way it is today, they're so brazen, they don't even care whether it's in secrecy or not. They just, they're now out in the open with their crime. They don't care about abolishing anything in the Constitution. They don't need to follow it. They're above the law, and they've got control of all of our mainstream information flow. And as a result of that, they simply say black is green, and if you think it's anything other than green, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist. I mean, that's what they've got in play, and so many people rely upon those mainstream information services that's how they form their opinions. They have a majority of the people out here who can't see the forest for the trees because they've got to tune it in on that boob tube,
Terry. And they started I can't remember the name of the movie that was on years ago, but it talked about computers, and it came back to talking about the computer itself. And that is exactly what we have today. And that was the title of what the bottom line was: garbage in, garbage out. So that is what is happening to the American public, is the media, which is owned and controlled by the powers that be, which you just alluded to. And we can go back to William Casey, 1981, quote, "We will know that our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false," unquote. That was in 1981, almost 40 years ago. So
they
have been totally successful. So all you give the American public is 24 hours of the lobotomy box on the Communist News Network. Fox is just as bad. Maybe not just as bad, but they're not good. So here you have these people giving everyone in America constant information. It's repetitive. It's over and over and over and over and over, and they say the same things. Sometimes they contradict themselves on the same page, but nobody pays any attention. So you have a country of people who are graduates of the public school system, who have been taught that authority, whatever the authority says, is what you do, and then you give them 24 hours of complete manure out of their media systems, and the people make decisions. Garbage in, garbage out. The people make decisions based on falsehoods, and they keep doing it over and over and over again, and that's why we're in the mess we're in. But to go back to show that back then how they didn't even follow their own rules, as I said before, Luther Martin protested, and he said, "Look, you can't tell me." Now, he said it much more eloquent than I am. I'm paraphrasing what he said. But he said to Washington and the committee, "You can't tell me that all of the brilliance of this great country are here in this room. You can't tell me that all of the bright people are here and everybody else is below us in mental acuity. You can't tell me that. So you're telling me that as a representative from the people of Maryland, I can't even contact my people back home, my people in my state, my people in my town. I can't even contact those people and ask them for their opinion of what we're doing. It can only be here." And he was told, yes, that's the rules. So Alexander Hamilton leaves the Constitutional Convention after his theory of monarchy was rejected on June 18th. He leaves shortly thereafter and goes back to New York. Well, while he's in New York, he writes a letter to George Washington, telling George Washington about the brilliant people in New York he has talked to about the convention, and he sends Washington their ideas. He doesn't name them, But he talks about the ones he talked to in New Jersey, and he talks, and then the ones he saw in New York. And these are all the brightest minds in the country that he's talking to. And then he sends suggestions back to Washington. Here is Washington, who is the chairman or the president of the Constitutional Convention. He's the one who set about making the rules and telling Luther Martin that we can't talk to anybody. But yet he gets letters from Alexander Hamilton admitting that he's breaking the rules. Now, you remember being taught about this in civics class, right?
Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah, right. Not quite, no. Mike, you've studied this. You've looked at all these source documents, and you've made a few other connections. You've gone and dug into it. Who was behind these Federalists? Who were they in cahoots with? To pull off, you know, authorizing this Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause and getting rid of the words of expressly out of the 10th Amendment, you know, there were means behind the madness here, and these guys were backed up and connected and financed. Who are they in cahoots with?
Well, Terry, I don't think, in my opinion, and I sell it for what it's worth, in my opinion, it was the Bank of England. And I have felt from the beginning that they were very much involved with this. We can take one character in particular, Alexander Hamilton. John Adams described him, was the bastard pup of a Scottish trader, is what John Adams referred to Alexander Hamilton as. Alexander Hamilton's mother's husband was Jewish, Levine. Now, Hamilton is said was a bastard stepchild of a James Hamilton. But his mother and his father, Levine, never split. But as a teenager, suddenly Hamilton is sent from Nevis with all kinds of money to the U.S., to attend the best colleges, the best schools, all of this other stuff. And then he gets an in almost automatically with George Washington, especially during the Revolutionary War. And there's so many things that you can link Hamilton to. In 1781, when the Congress decides, under the Articles of Confederation, decides to appoint Robert Morris as the financier of the war, giving him almost dictatorial powers, he gets a letter from whom? Alexander Hamilton, who is supposed to be an aide-de-camp to George Washington, involved in fighting the British, and where in the dickens did he get time to send a letter to Robert Morris telling him how he should construct the first bank of the United States, which ends up being the Bank of North America. So he sends this to Robert Morris. Here's what I think you should do. Here's the things to do. And so Morris takes that up and creates the Bank of North America. So we've already talked about the debtors for that. Okay, so then after the war, Alexander Hamilton is Washington's second choice for Secretary of Treasury. His first choice was Robert Morris. Robert Morris turned it down because he was a senator from Pennsylvania. He wanted to be senator instead of, and so he recommended Hamilton. So Washington gets Hamilton. One of the first things Hamilton does is to create another bank, which is the first U.S. bank. And then you know, how wonderful this is because, you know, Hamilton has already created his own bank, which is still active today, Terry, in New York. The Bank of Mellon, M-E-L-L-O-N, or Mellon, or however you want to pronounce that. But Alexander Hamilton was a member of Washington's staff, his aide-de-camp. But in right after the war is officially over, Hamilton starts a bank in New York, which is the one we just mentioned, and he starts loaning the government money. And so he is picked as Secretary of Treasury, and so then he creates the first U.S. bank and does, in essence, the exact same thing that Robert Morris did with the first bank of North America. Creates the wealthy people in the country become the stockholders of the bank, which loans the government money. The Bank of North America, the first U.S. bank, the second U.S. bank, all of this eventually becomes the Federal Reserve. And if we go back to the Bank of England, we go back to William Paterson, the founder of the Bank of England, 1694, and he says, you know, which is just so prophetic, this bank will enjoy the profits of money which we create out of nothing. Now, there's nothing to back, there was no gold or silver to back up the bank for the Bank of North America except that $400,000 that was loaned to us by France. That was gold and silver. The Bank of the United States under Hamilton, which was chartered for 20 years, was the same thing, was created out of, you know, and they immediately go into fractional reserve banking. Okay, we've got $1 million. We can loan $10 million. So we get interest off of money we have created out of nothing. Goes right back to the founding statement of the Bank of North America. The Bank of England. So you got any questions about that, my friend?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty clear. I mean, just how corrupt that whole process was and what the motives of these people were. They weren't, they were not trying to create a document that would be controlled by the people or really even a consent of the governed, because they already had that in the Articles of Confederation and they wanted to do away with that. And they wanted to create a circumstance where the moneyed powers could have more control and basically live off the sweat of the brows of the people of the United States. We're a little over halfway through here tonight, and I think it would be a good time to segue into the other thing you wanted to discuss, and that is the war on the white race, or as I said, it's really a war on all pure races. You want to launch into that at this point, and then we can kind of come back and pull it full circle?
Well, let me run one quote by you before we do this. And a member of the U.S. Congress in 1809, now this would have been under James Madison, this member of Congress, his name was Peter Buell Porter. Now, I know everybody heard about him when they were in high school. But anyway, here is something he said that I think is most relevant. And what they were doing was talking about renewing the First Bank of the United States. It had a 20-year charter. So we're at 1809. It's going to its charter will run out in 1811. There's already a lot of opposition, especially had been created by Albert Gallatin, who was Jefferson's Secretary of Treasury, and also Jefferson. Both of them had created a lot of feedback, not wanting the bank because under very shortly, within 5 or 6 years of the creation of the Bank of Platon, prices had risen something like 76% under this bank. But anyway, the bank is about, they're talking about renewing the bank or not renewing the bank in 1809 in Congress. And Peter Buell Porter says this, quote, "Let the principle of construction or implied power, which was found in the Necessary and Proper Clause, be once established in the extent to which it must be carried in order to pass this bill for the renewal of the U.S. Bank, and you will have planted in the bosom of this Constitution a viper, which one day or another will sting the liberties of this country to its heart," unquote.
I think we need to set a precedent before we launch into this next topic, and I just would like to set some how do you call it, a little bit of a disclaimer. It's my belief that that all human beings on the face of this earth are descendants of Noah, originally of Adam, but eventually of Noah. I do not believe that one race is in any way superior to another. I believe that we all have our origins in different cultural environments, and that the level of knowledge that someone has certainly is greatly determined by the culture that we grew up in, the education that we grew up in. So I just want to get that on the table to start this discussion, that I believe we're all put here by the same Creator, and that everyone on the face of this earth has an equal amount of love from our Creator, and that we owe due respect and honor and everything to everyone that is born on the face of this earth. So with that put forth, I assume, Mike, that you would agree with those comments.
Absolutely, Terry. And here's another thing I've talked about many times. Prior to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, naturally slavery in this country existed. White slaves and black slaves. The first 3,000 slaves brought to this country were whites under King James. They were white slaves, and they were usually Irish or Scottish, sometimes others. All of this is documented. But we had that slavery. But prior to that, slavery had never been codified into government or legalized. Slavery of any race of people was not codified or legalized into a government until the Constitution of 1787. So this is when we start talking about race, you know, it's automatically, and I understand you've given the disclaimer, I understand that, and I appreciate it. But to me, this is something that has destroyed our country, is this constant pitting of people against each other. Black, white, conservative, liberal, which is a bastardized meaning of the word liberty, progressives, religions, everything, as long as you can keep the people hating and fighting each other, nobody pays any attention to what government's doing. Because all of the different factions believe that the way to have their way, to control everything, is to take control of government. They don't realize that government is what has caused all of these issues. And if you want to talk about the most racist branch of the United States government, it has to be the Supreme Court. And we could go into that, you know, for forever. But yes, we do have, obviously, Terry, a demonization that has occurred. You know, we're going to go into the military. We're going to have transgender people, and we're going to pay for their surgeries, and we're going to do all of this stuff for transgender people. But we're going to make damn sure we get rid of white supremacists. So what is a white supremacist? Are the people who oppose white supremacists, are they a different color supremacist? Or is there a quality thing here, equality thing we're looking at? Is that the bottom line? Are we looking at equality, as which was said in our Declaration of Independence? And everybody laughs at the Declaration of Independence, that we were all, you know, created equal, and people get upset. Well, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. Yes, he did. But have you ever read the paragraph that Thomas Jefferson wanted to include into the Declaration of Independence that the other states wouldn't let him do? North and South. And, you know, I think it was Jefferson that described slavery as having a wolf by the ears. You can't hold on. You can't let go. Thing you want to pursue from this angle, Terry?
Well, there's a lot, because, you see, you look at the Bank of England, the City of London, the Crown, as it is known as, and I'm not referring necessarily to the Queen and King, but the moneyed pockets that actually run the City of London, which is the banking community of England. These people, these bloodlines that control the central banks, were not a pure race, and they were under threat from pure races, and they actually lost their country of Khazaria back in like the 11th century, either late 11th or early 12th century. I guess it was early 12th century that they lost their country, and they were under threat from purebred Arabs on one side and purebred whites on the other. And they all converted. They were pagan idol worshippers, and they converted to Talmudic Kabbalism, Judaism. And they were not of the bloodline of Judah, so they had no inheritance of the Israelis of history. And these are the people who have been run out of like 30 different countries. After they lost their country of Khazaria, they literally were banned out of 30 different countries. I think Spain was the first to boot them out because of their unethical business practices and their pagan ceremonies that they continued to do, even though they became Talmudic Kabbalists, which the Talmud calls for prayer to Lucifer. So these people pray to Lucifer. And they are not a pure race, and they lost their country. These are the same people that were behind Hamilton, as you said. They were in cahoots with those that were basically setting up the people of the United States to pay taxes, to pay interest on a fraudulent debt on a perpetual basis, therefore allowing them to allowing them to live off of the sweat of other people's brow. And these are the people who started things like the NAACP. The NAACP was not started by blacks or any other minority of race of pure race. It was started by these mongrelized pagans, and I believe, it's my personal belief, that it was started deliberately so that they could stir up the race baiting between blacks and whites and any other minorities for that matter. And I believe that that's been its function all along. And they were these mongrelized Khazarian bloodlines controlled that for many years. This is also who's behind the ADL and the SPLC. These people are there to stir it up and to create chaos and to put their Hegelian dialectics into place. And that's what they've been doing. That's what they did in 1787, and they've been doing it ever since. They did it in 1871. They did it in Reconstruction. They did it during the World Wars, World War I, World War II. They're the ones that created the Great Depression. There was no accident or natural economic cycle that occurred. They actually created the problem by tightening credit, which they've done repeatedly in order to create cycles that they could make more money off of. They've been behind the scenes, and they are the ones that have created all, because they have no conscience, these people. They don't care about the life of the United States people or anybody else on the globe. These people are ruthless, and they will do whatever it takes to keep control and to continue to put themselves on a pedestal and enslave everybody else that they can possibly. They're the ones behind the media. They bought the media. They bought up all of the newspapers back around the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th century forward. They created the movie production studios. These are all the same people. So this whole, the call for the con started with people like George Soros, who's a Hungarian Jew. He's one of the Khazarian bloodlines. These are the people that we have been fighting all along. But if you try to resist their narrative in any way, you're either a racist or an anti-Semite or a conspiracy theorist, because you simply question the lies that they're putting forward. Did I say enough, Mike?
Yes, Terry, and very well. One of the things I would like to, you know, and I'm not sure if we've ever gone into this, but, you know, the South gets, and the people who fought for the Confederacy get the blunt end of this, and they're tearing down statues and all of this other stuff. And here is the thing that is, you know, just really bothers me about this, is the fact that the Civil War probably would not have occurred if things. And that is, number one, was Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a book which had just supernatural circulation in a time frame where a number one bestseller sold 200 copies. Somehow Uncle Tom's Cabin saw wide distribution all over the place. The other thing that probably brought about the misnamed Civil War was the Dred Scott v. Sanford decision before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857. Ironically, Dred Scott, a slave, had been carried into a free territory, Wisconsin, by his owner. And because of that, it was stipulated that if you took a slave into a free territory, that slave became free. Dred Scott sued his owner in Missouri, which was considered a southern or a border state, and Dred Scott sued his owner, and he was granted his freedom in the Missouri courts. So then his owner allegedly appeals that to the Missouri Supreme Court. And so the Missouri Supreme Court says, no, he's still a slave. They ignore all kind of precedent, all kind of law, and everything else. Anyway, I don't want to go into a whole 11-year detail of the Dred Scott case. But the Dred Scott case stayed in the courts for 11 years. Where did a slave get the money to keep that case in the courts, moving from local court in Missouri to the Missouri Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court twice? Where does a slave get that kind of money? And number two, why would the person who owned a slave spend that kind of money over an 11-year period of time to keep a slave? And then why, shortly after the 1857 decision by the Supreme Court declaring he was still a slave and that blacks had no rights, how in the world would they go through 11 years of fighting in the courts, and then right after he is declared to be a slave and all other blacks are declared to be slaves, would they set him free after 11 years of legal struggle and all of the money it took to do that? And then, of course, the South would list in their secession documents, they would mention slavery because the Supreme Court had said slavery was constitutional. So anyone today who is writing a brief for court will cite the Constitution that their position is constitutional. That's exactly what the South was doing. Over 90% of the Southern men who went to war did not own slaves. Now, I don't know where you live or what you think about, but where in the world are you going to get people who don't own slaves to go to war and die so other people can have them? Logically, it makes no sense. And then again, let's think about something called the Hazard Circular that came out before the war started. And so the Hazard Circular says, slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery abolished. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of labor, while the European plan led on by England is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. The great debt that capitalists will see to is made out of the Civil War must be used to control the value of money. To accomplish this, the government bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now awaiting for the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States to make this recommendation. Bank of England says they own the Secretary of Treasury of the United States, Salmon P. Chase, and they're waiting for him to make this determination. It will not do to allow greenbacks, as they are called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that, but we can control the bonds and through them the bank issues. Hazard Circular issued out of London about the Civil War, and I just read it to you.
And so they've enslaved.
And so it enslaved everybody. And we had at the beginning of the Civil War, let's take 1860. Look at the national debt in 1860. Which was somewhere, depending on which source you look at, somewhere between $68 and $90 million. Now, what's the interest on $68 to $90 million? What was the debt at the end of the Civil War? Somewhere near well, a little over $3 billion. So who profited from the Civil War? It certainly wasn't the South, where almost everything was destroyed. And, you know, a lot of people do not know that Sherman's march to the sea across the state of Georgia was the fourth worst ecological disaster in the history of this planet. Cui bono? Who made money from this setup? There is a was a book that was published in 1867 by Henry Clay Dean. And it was, and I have that book. If anyone can find it these days, I think there have been some reprints. It's The Crimes of the Civil War and the Curse of the Funding System. Henry Clay Dean was a judge. And he was also a minister, and he was from Iowa, and he had protested Abraham Lincoln's policies, and Abraham Lincoln administration had put him in prison without due process. After the war, he wrote the book that I just talked about. Now, if you read the book, you're going to read passages in there that in today's vernacular are racist as can be. Do not try to judge that by today, but especially go into the financial aspects of that book if you want to read something that will just really light up the scoreboard about who
did you just describe,
ran this war.
Did you just describe a bill of attainder?
Yes, very much so. But have you heard of that book or read it, Terry?
No.
The Crimes of the Civil War and the Curse of the Funding System. Judge Henry Clay Dean put together just an absolute beautiful piece, but it people will not read it. People are told not to read it because it's got racist passages in it. But you have to understand
times. I've heard of all of that, but I just never have read that book. I've heard of all of that. I just never read that book.
Well, it's there's tough passages for me because I certainly, you know, I think one of the most heinous crimes in the world was one race of people thinking they can own another race of people. That to me is just absolutely absurd. But and I do not condone it in any way, shape, form, or fashion. But for the people of the South to have been attacked like they have been attacked, their history and their monuments. These people, many of them, slavery. Patrick Claiborne, the Stonewall of the West, was very much against, and he tried to get the Confederacy from the very first day of the war to free the slave. Did he quit fighting? Did Patrick Claiborne, who gave the ultimate sacrifice at the Battle of Franklin, did he quit fighting because his country would not do what he thought was the honorable thing to do as far as slavery was concerned? That is the part that bothers me, Terry, is that people, you know, we want to judge 1861 by 2021. And that's impossible. You can't do that with any clarity whatsoever.
Yeah, it's funny how people never talked about it, and now all of a sudden they want to call out 1871 as being, or going back to that time as being a solution for everything we're facing today.
Oh, my. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, as I've said on so many occasions, ignorance wouldn't be so bad if people weren't so damn proud of it.
Well, there's this new push for this CONCON, and it's a very scary thing because they've been trying to, you know, it shifted all the way back in the early 60s. It started out being pushed by people like Eric Holder and George Soros. And when they failed from the left, they restructured it, renamed it, now calling it a convention of states. It's still an Article 5 convention, no matter what you call it. And they are feeding out these lies, and they've been doing it for some time, and they work through the bar people and law professors that are government trained, and you know, it works hand in hand with the whole chaos situation with the races and the race baiting and everything, and it's just trying to destabilize our society and put them in a position where they can rewrite the Constitution. And it's not just a matter of is it possible that they could rewrite one? They've already got them written. They've got several of them written to consider if they have that. And we look at the examples that you've given, and there's no question that there's no question about that it would be similar now to what it was in 1787, and that is that the deep pockets would be the ones choosing the delegates. Even if the governors are given the right to have a delegate selection committee, they're going to pick those people who control them, and those are the deep pockets, the ones that have basically bought their political position. And those are the ones that are going to select.
Who do you think your governor would pick?
Well, it'd probably be some kind of transgender person who they control. They've got to have some kind of blackmail and bribery going on in order for them to control them, in order to pick them. I mean, Polis, you know, that guy's a pervert for starters. But on top of that, you know, he's bought his way in. If people knew what he was about in advance, I very seriously doubt him. They tried to recall him twice now already, and the only way he's going to get reelected here in Colorado, I'm confident, is if they cheat, and that may be how I got elected the first time.
Well, have you perchance read the book Constitution 2020?
I'm aware of it. I have not read the whole thing, but I have looked at it. Yes.
Do you know who the two composers were?
Well, I know they were funded. They were stooges of George Soros, and that whole group has been funded by Soros and his minions.
Well, the two guys who worked hand in hand, and I say that figuratively as well as literally, the two guys who worked hand in hand on that were Lawrence Tribe and Cass Sunstein. Do you know who else started that effort in 2011, 10 years ago? Do you know who else contributed heavily to that financially? Is that a no? Clear so. Are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am here. I don't know how I must have clicked the mute button. I didn't see that. Well, I know George Soros was involved in funding it, like MoveOn.org and folks like that. But I would think somehow, maybe not directly, but indirectly, Rockefeller would probably be involved.
Well, don't forget the Koch brothers.
Right.
The Koch brothers and Soros, and they had a big convention at Harvard University in 2011. And the Koch brothers and Soros fronted the money for this entire effort. And they set it up just like they set up everything else, so that it would appear to be adversarial. because you've got people who are claiming we need a con because of what the liberals are trying to do to the country, and you've got the exact same dynamic working the other way around because the liberals can point to the Koch brothers, one of which is deceased now, but he wasn't at the time, and then the you know, the conservatives can point at Soros. It's the same dynamic they keep playing over and over and over again. Everybody thinks they're being adversarial, but the thing is controlled by one central theme.
I want to urge anybody who's listening to this to, first of all, go and read Article 5 of the Constitution. It is an Article 5 convention. It's under the Article 5 that any convention of states or constitutional convention will be called. And here's three principles that you need to understand. And anybody that disputes this is lying to you, and you can see that if you simply read Article 5. One, the U.S. Congress will determine the call and how the delegates are selected. So the people in the states will not have control over who the delegates are. Number two, the rules of the convention will be determined after the convention meets and elects its officers. Any rules put forth in advance will be moot. They will have little or no effect on what the rules will be. Number three, there is no provision in Article 5 or anywhere else that the scope of a convention can be limited to a balanced budget or any other issue. Just as in the 1787, the scope will be open for determination by the delegates of the convention and will not be limited by any rule put in place in advance. Another point is that if the state withdraws its delegate, just as in the case of New York, they didn't withdraw, the two delegates left on their own accord. They weren't called back by the state of New York, to my knowledge. And they left Hamilton without a vote because he no longer had a quorum. But the process proceeded without them. So if you think that a state can control the scope of the convention by recalling their delegates in the event that the scope of the convention exceeds the authority given to that delegate, you're badly mistaken, because it went right on. You heard Mike say how many delegates left and how few were remaining, yet they came up with a whole new constitution and managed to put it forth and get it ratified. So that will not control the scope of the convention. So anybody that gives you information, whether it's law professors or anyone associated with the Convention of States, if they tell you otherwise, know that they are not speaking the truth to you. We've got about 3 minutes, Mike. Closing comments.
Well, Terry, it seems like when we get into these subjects that we are passionate about, it seems like time flies. You know, there's so many other things that I think both of us could add to this discussion, but it has been most interesting. I would caution everyone. You know, I think so many times of Marcus Tullius Cicero and what he said. He said, "The people who are ignorant of their history will be forever children." And when we look around us today and we look at the level of ignorance about what actually happened as far as the founding of this country, and we look at people making decisions on just outright fabrications and revisionist history, and plus throw in 24 hours of the Communist News Network and fake news and all of the other events that we have. And people try to center yourself, you know, and center yourself to where you can, if you don't have time to research, don't just believe what everybody tells you. Take the time, because we're in one of the most critical periods of American history. And this country is either going to survive or fail on what happens, I believe, within the next 6 months to a year. We're either going to be here or we're not going to be here. And I know we're not here now as the country I grew up in. That country's gone. Can we recover it? It's going to depend on the people. I don't think it's going to depend on the government. So that would be my point at this time, Jerry.
Well, you mentioned people doing their own research. Our good friend up in Montana, Dr. Kate, who is listening tonight, I'll give her credit for this report on Montana, that the CONCON, the Constitutional Convention, called for up there, which was being heard in committee, was voted down 7-4, but there are a group of corrupt senators up there in God's country, Montana, who are attempting to blast it out to the floor, to a floor vote, in spite of the committee shooting it down. It's not likely, but it's possible that it was blasted out there today. And that is a report from Dr. Kate. I'll also add that there are three places I would suggest people to go and do their own research. One would be the Secure Arkansas site, which you're well familiar with, Mike. Another one would be the Eagle Forum. Go and look at what they say about an Article 5. If you want to see the best compilation of articles and writings about an Article 5 convention, go online and look for, do a search for managing an Article 5, and you will find a booklet that you can read online for free that was put together by Karen Roof, Dr. Karen Roof, and Mr. Bollinger of the Sherman Institute. And so it's called Managing an Article 5. You'll be able to find it, and it's an online booklet, and it will give you all the information you know to fight against. And you can print that out, actually, and give it to your elected officials. I've been doing everything here in Colorado that I can to educate anybody that'll listen regarding this, and I've put that booklet in a number of people's hands. And those people who have seen it will never support a call for an Article 5 CONCON again. Thank you, Mike. It is another great history lesson. Really appreciate you, brother. I'm glad to have Dr. Kate listening to us tonight. So I'm just going to say goodnight to everyone, and we'll see you next Thursday night on Handling the Truth. Good night, Mike.
Hey, good night, Jerry. Good night, Dr. Kate. Thanks for listening. Please welcome Disturbed.
Darkness, my own friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night, and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking without speaking, silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I